In Reinventing Bach, Paul Eli tells the story of how musicians of genius have made Bach's music new in our time. At once restoring Bach as a universally revered composer and revolutionizing the ways that music figures into our lives. As a musician in 18th century Germany, Bach was on the technological frontier, restoring organs, inventing instruments, and perfecting the tuning system still in use today. Two centuries later, pioneering musicians began to take advantage of breakthroughs in audio recordings to make Bach's music the sound of modern transcendence, technically savvy artist. Reinventing Bach is the story of music, invention, and human passion. Paul Eli, for many years, was a senior editor with FSG, now senior fellow with Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs, and it's a great pleasure to welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
I'm very happy to be with you. Thanks for having me as a guest.
It is a pleasure to have you aboard. At what point did you think that, when did you start to put all these pieces together, that Bach was of interest to you and there was a case to be made?
Well, I wrote a book about 10 years ago called The Life You Saved May Be Your Own, about four American Catholic writers. And in writing that book, figured out how to tell different stories together and, you know, braid them together as one story. Around that time, I realized that's what was necessary if I was going to tell the story of how Bach's music was reinvented in our time. You had different musicians in different countries, more or less contemporary, joined together by recordings. One thing led to another, and I found myself bringing the story from the 30s up to the present.
When you think about it, can you, for yourself, understand why Bach? Why it was Bach that ultimately you fell very hard for?
A couple of reasons. I think the balance of order and freedom in his music really appeals to me. The music really trucks along with great regularity as far as its tempo goes, and yet its harmonies, its different, you know, lines of melody and structure. There's a remarkable variation there, and that it feels so rooted and yet so exploratory at the same time, and that appeals to me. On top of that, really Bach, as classical composers go, was more open to the adaptation of his music for other instruments and other contexts than most composers. So we hear Bach's music in all sorts of different ways, played on a synthesizer, on a guitar, on a cello, in a ringtone, and that suits Bach's music, let's say, better than it does the music of some other composers. So it's accessible that way.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you're a senior fellow with Georgetown University's Berkeley Center for Religion, Peace, and World Affairs. You write in the book that you sought something religious in the recordings of Bach's music. What do you mean by that? What were you looking for?
It didn't come all at once, but as I spent a lot of time listening to recordings of Bach's music, I began to think, well, what happens when we listen to recordings? A classic definition of religion is a binding back. That's what religio means. A recording, by definition, was made in the past. It's made, you know, prior to the time we're listening to it. And that's apparent when we're listening to an old Beatles record, say, but it's really apparent when you're listening to a recording of Bach that's made, say, in 1915 by Pablo Casals. You're hearing it in a kind of triple time. There's the time that of its composition. You know, Bach wrote the cello music, let's say, in 1715, the time when it was recorded a couple of centuries later by Pablo Casals, and the present time that you're, you know, sitting in a room listening to that recording. So if you give any attention to that, you're suddenly really aware of the different ways we're joined to the past and the way our experience of the past pervades our present experience.
That intersection of past and present, I'm curious as to, and I thought about this while reading the book, of what that means when we're talking about an experience? I mean, you mentioned the Beatles, for example. The Beatles obviously still have an impact today. We can directly look at artists who were impacted by the Beatles and who have very strong influences from them. And I think also the case that you make, which we can talk about in a few moments, about technology, can also be made as well. What is it about Bach, do you think, that makes a difference than us discussing the influence of Dickens today or Beethoven or Mozart?
Well, in some respects, you know, as you're implying, we feel the influence of Dickens, we feel the influence of Mozart, they're open to adaptation. I would argue that the music of Bach is designed for adaptation, for transposition into new contexts more than the work of those other artists. I saw a presentation of A Christmas Carol about a month ago, and it made clear just how rooted in Victorian England Dickens' music, Dickens' writing is. That's not to take anything away from it, but it doesn't make much sense if you can't get back to Victorian London somehow. When you think about Bach, I think it's possible to listen to the music of Bach with full enjoyment without being aware that it was made in Leipzig on a particular day, or that Bach was a certain kind of Lutheran, or that he had certain kind of family arrangements. You can leave that aside and still come to a profound appreciation of the music.
An appreciation that you can find in other classical musicians considered the greats.
Certainly. And you know, this is a sticking point. One asks, well, why not Mozart? Why not Beethoven? 20 years ago, there was something of a popular Mozart revival going on, following on Amadeus. And yet, to some extent, that subsided. And to some extent, the resurrection of Mozart very much had to do with his personality, with the quarrels with Salieri, with his father, with his early death, with his flamboyant character. Ditto when we think about Beethoven. You don't go too far into the popularization of Beethoven without the picture of that guy with his crop of hair, or the story of his deafness, or scratching out the dedication to Napoleon on the Third Symphony, etc. There's something impersonal about the adaptation of Bach for our time that I think makes it really suitable for the age of recordings, the age we live in now.
How conscious do you believe Bach was of that?
I don't think he was looking into our particular future, but all the evidence suggests that he was composing music that would outlast him in ways that he couldn't quite imagine. Much of it he adapted himself. He would write a piece, say, to celebrate the arrival of a prince in town, and then adapt it for a sacred work. He would write a piece for one instrument and then adapt it for another. He would do further adaptations on his own famous works, not famous in his own time, like the Goldberg Variations. No sooner was it printed than he started working out further variations. So I think he anticipated and planned for the fact that people were going to take his music to places he couldn't imagine. So in that sense, I don't think it's too much to say he was very open to the kind of adaptation that his music has undergone.
As I mentioned, you alluded to this earlier in writing about, in great detail, about the technology. And one of the things that you see in the book, and you make it very obvious, that technology has given us this extraordinary access to the past. And I'm curious as to when you started to make that connection of why technology was so important in the story.
A couple of things happened. One is that as I got to know a little bit about Bach, I came to realize how relatively limited his own encounter with his music was. I remember one day cleaning my apartment with a recording of the St. Matthew Passion on and realizing that I had heard 3 or 4 different versions of the St. Matthew Passion just in that Lenten season. I owned them. And it occurred to me that Bach only heard the St. Matthew Passion 2 or 3 times in his life. He could only get the forces together to have it performed. The liturgical calendar called for its performance 2 or 3 times. So here I was, an ordinary aficionado, cleaning his apartment, listening to the St. Matthew Passion, having heard it more than the composer himself had heard it. That stunned me and made me ponder some of the quality specific to recordings. For example, that we get to play them over and over again, and that kind of reflection, multiplied a few times, led me to try to put it together as a story.
One of the characters in the book is Pablo Casals, who you mentioned, one of the 20th century's greatest cellists. What do you think is pertinent about his story and his discovery of Bach?
So as the story goes, Casals was already a great prodigy, celebrated in Catalonia, when he and his father walked into a dusty music shop one day. Casals was in his teens, early teens, and found the solo cello work of Bach and in sheet music, which he then took home. The astonishing thing is that having supposedly discovered the cello suites, he didn't know about them, his teachers had never told him about them, Casals didn't rush right out to debut this little-known work, astonishing work, for the public. He spent 12 years mastering the cello suites in private, and then when he took them public, it was only one of the suites, and typically just part of one of the suites that he would play in concert. So another 35 years passed before he made the now canonical recordings of the cello suites beginning at Abbey Road in 1936. It's easy in retrospect to think, well, Casals could take his time. He lived into his 90s, but he didn't know he was going to live into his 90s, that he would take such a long time to touch bottom with the cello suites. It's profoundly surprising to me and a reminder of the depth of encounter that a real musician can have with the music of Bach.
When there were times when I was reading the book that I could just imagine you writing, and the book is beautifully written, that I could just imagine you writing and listening to music. I assume there was a soundtrack to this while you were writing.
Definitely. It wasn't as rigorous as you might expect. Often I had to listen to the music in advance of writing about it. A lot of my encounter with the music of Bach came while I was writing my first book. I listened to Bach constantly. So then by the time I got down to writing the book about Bach, I had a sense of of what I wanted to do and what the music was about. And then, I would organize the recordings I needed into one of my son's shoeboxes, 20 or 30 CDs, and kind of put them in a rough order and then work through it over a few weeks and put together a narrative. It's really striking to me how seldom writers about classical music make reference to recordings, to the quality of the recordings, and also to the fact that we know exactly when they were made. Somebody like Glenn Gould, his story is totally different if you actually just work out what he made when and how one recording led to another. And that's what I was able to do just by virtue of the fact that there have been so many reissues of his records over the past 30 years.
You include a wonderful quote from Albert Einstein in the book. This is what I have to say about Bach's life and work. Listen, play, love, revere, and keep your mouth shut. The name of the book is Reinventing Bach. It is published by FSG. Paul Eli, a great pleasure to have you on the program. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joe.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.